Without objection.
Mr. Speaker, on this historic day, the House of Representatives opens its proceedings for the first time to televised coverage. I wish to congratulate you for your courage in making this possible, and the committee who has worked so hard under the leadership of Congressman Charles Rose to make this a reality. Television will change this institution, Mr. Speaker, just as it has changed the executive branch. But the good will far outweigh the bad. From this day forward, every member of this body must ask himself or herself how many Americans are listening to the debates which are made. When the House becomes comfortable with the changes brought by television coverage, the news media will be allowed to bring their own cameras into this chamber. In the meantime, there is no censorship. Every word is available for broadcast coverage, and journalists will be able to use and edit as they see fit. The solution for the lack of confidence in government...
Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network, or C-SPAN, is an American cable and satellite television network. As a nonprofit public service, it televised a live feed of a U.S. House of Representatives session for the first time on March 19, 1979. C-SPAN broadcasts U.S. federal government proceedings and other public affairs programming. In its early years, few people watched the channel, but as Representative Al Gore noted, television would quickly change the institution. Newt Gingrich, a Republican from Georgia, and a U.S. House representative who was initially overlooked by his party's leadership, identified C-SPAN as a tool to carve his path to power. Gingrich became known for his confrontational manner, described by some as arrogant, ferocious, and indifferent to the truth. His tactics were reminiscent of Joseph McCarthy, who had a meteoric rise in politics behind sensational and baseless accusations of communism and relentless investigations to attack political opponents during the late 1940s and early 1950s.
We're going to the fifth investigation of McCarthy. There will be a sixth, there will be a seventh and an eighth, as long as I continue to try to expose people who are traitors to this country. If I would quit now, why, we'd end with the fifth investigation. But take my word for it, my good friend, regardless, and I make you this solemn promise, regardless of what this Senate may do about a censure, this fight to expose those who would destroy this nation will go on and on.
With a massive cult-like following, who only trusted his words, McCarthy was untouchable and one of the most powerful politicians of the time. However, questions around his involvement in a blackmail conspiracy that led to the suicide of one fellow senator, and his baseless accusations that the U.S. Army harbored communists, eventually weakened his political power. Then, he gradually lost his public popularity and credibility after several of his accusations were found to be false. But ultimately, his own premature death from alcoholism at the age of 48 brought an end to this era of political tactics referred to as McCarthyism. What allowed McCarthy to engage in these tactics unchecked for a time was what is referred to as the speech or debate clause in the Constitution, which states, "The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services, to be ascertained by law, and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. They shall in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of their respective houses, and in going to and returning from the same. And for any speech or debate in either house, they shall not be questioned in any other place." Prior to 1689, the English crown often used its power to prosecute and control the courts to punish or intimidate members of parliament who spoke against it. Inspired by this history, the U.S. Constitution's speech or debate clause protects Congress members from being questioned in court for their legislative actions. This safeguard ensures their independence, prevents intimidation by the executive branch, and avoids distractions from their duties, covering both government actions and private lawsuits. However, when abused, the clause enables a congressperson to make any false accusations, engage in sham investigations, and intentionally distribute false information for their personal or political benefit. Newt Gingrich, who frequently refers to himself as a student of history, saw a similar opportunity in the post-Watergate era. He weaponized government reforms that were intended to fight corruption to instead attack his political opponents, now with the direct public audience on C-SPAN. He took to the floor of Congress daily, not to propose legislation, but to accuse Democrats of corruption, sometimes attacking fellow legislators by name. To C-SPAN viewers, Gingrich appeared as a strong, dominating force. But off-camera, the House chamber was actually empty. Representative Jack Brooks, a Democrat from Texas, saw this as an abuse of the cameras and asked the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, to have the cameras show the empty seats. Gingrich argued that the Speaker was violating the rules, characterizing it as further proof of Democratic corruption. Tip O'Neill, a man of domineering physical stature, a bulky 6 foot 3 inch frame, with his memorable unruly thatch of white hair and bulbous nose, was considered a kind and clever man. He reportedly navigated rough political waters with a smile, trying to avoid the bitterness that was beginning to characterize Washington in the 1980s. He famously said, quote, "All politics is local," stressing to fellow congressional leaders that the people sent them there and that it was the government's responsibility to improve life of ordinary people. Known for his personal charm, political skill, and social programs, he held the longest uninterrupted tenure as Speaker of the House, 10 years, and was regarded as one of the most effective House leaders of the 20th century. But in a full chamber, Speaker O'Neill was compelled to confront Gingrich.
My personal opinion is this. You deliberately stood on that well before an emptied house and challenged these people, and you challenged their Americanism. And it's the lowest thing that I've ever seen in my 32 years in Congress.
Mr. Speaker, if I may reclaim my time, let me say first of all...
O'Neill's comments were followed by Representative Trent Lott, who would request that O'Neill's words be taken down from the record, arguing that the language was a personal attack, forbidden by House rules. The House parliamentarian struck O'Neill's words from the record, a rare rebuke of a sitting speaker. The major TV networks picked up the dispute, which was exactly what Gingrich wanted. He observed, quote, "The number one fact about the news media is they love fights," end quote. This exchange exemplified Gingrich's approach, creating confrontation to turn any disagreement into a national story, elevating his standing. Elected to Congress in 1978, Gingrich believed a GOP majority would emerge if the party nationalized elections, differentiated itself from the opposition, and undermined the Democratic Party's reputation. He cast himself as a savior in the fight of good versus evil. He transformed political rhetoric from policy discussions to vitriol, calling Democratic speakers of the House crooks, traitors, and thugs. Gingrich and his allies accused some Democrats of being communist sympathizers, enraging and directing his followers' anger with remarks like,
"The value of the left cripple human beings, weaken cities, make it difficult for us to in fact survive as a country. The left in America is to blame for most of the current major diseases which have struck the society."
Some Republicans were disturbed by the shift, but party leaders enjoyed the results. Gingrich rose through the ranks to lead a political action committee, or PAC, that was dedicated to helping his party win elections. Under his leadership, the PAC advised others to, quote, "speak like Newt," using words like decay, traitors, radical, sick, destroy, pathetic, corruption, and shame when referring to Democrats. When Democrats regained Senate control in 1986, and Texas Democrat Jim Wright became Speaker of the House, Gingrich launched a two-year ethics investigation against him, partially driven by Wright's opposition to aid for the Nicaragua Contras. The investigation involved leaks affecting Wright's family and disrupted congressional operations. On May 31, 1989, Wright addressed the entire House.
It is intolerably hurtful to our government that qualified members of the executive and legislative branches are resigning because of the ambiguities and the confusion surrounding the ethics laws and because of their own consequent vulnerability to personal attack. That's a shame. It's happening. And it is grievously hurtful to our society. And vilification becomes an accepted form of political debate. When negative campaigning becomes a full-time occupation, when members of each party become self-appointed vigilantes, carrying out personal vendettas against members of the other party. God's name, that's not what this institution is supposed to be all about. When vengeance becomes more desirable than vindication, harsh personal attacks upon one another's motives and one another's character drown out the quiet logic of serious debate on important issues, things that we ought to be involved ourselves in. Surely that's unworthy of our institution, unworthy of our American political process. All of us in both political parties must resolve to bring this period of mindless cannibalism to an end. There's been enough of it.
After a standing ovation, Wright went on to announce his resignation as Speaker of the House, effective upon the election of his successor. Gingrich spoke of waging a civil war against liberals, telling supporters at the Heritage Foundation,
"This war has to be fought with a scale and a duration and a savagery that is only true of civil wars."
The Heritage Foundation, for its part, shifted its focus from changing the government through the executive branch to Congress. It published studies like The Imperial Congress, Crisis in the Separation of Powers from 1988, and The Ruling Class Inside the Imperial Congress, 1993. Which influenced the Contract with America, a legislative agenda advocated by Republicans in the 1994 congressional campaign. This tactical and philosophical groundwork formed the foundation of politics from the mid-1990s on. Gingrich rose to become the 50th Speaker of the House in 1995, and by the time he left Congress in 1999, he had instituted a combative, tribal, angry attitude in politics that would infect national discourse for decades. I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Going Green.
Why is this administration rushing headlong into signing a treaty in Kyoto this December? The scientific data is inconclusive, even contradictory. The economic costs are clear and devastating. This treaty would be a lead weight on our nation's future economic growth, killing jobs and opportunities for generations of Americans to come.
If any of these groups, the British, the Jewish, or the administration, stops agitating for war, I believe there will be little danger of our involvement.
In the previous episode, we discussed the rise of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, in 1988, influenced by the public's growing concern for the environment. I highlighted how historical injustices, like discriminatory housing practices, have led to environmental disparities. The episode also covered the formation of the Federalist Society in 1982, a conservative legal group aiming to influence U.S. law. Finally, I explored the environmental policies of President George H.W. Bush, including the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, and the politicization of environmental issues, especially climate change. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. As we discussed, the 1970s saw a shift in architecture towards sustainable design, influenced by the energy crisis. By 1989, this evolution led to the creation of the AIA Committee on the Environment to promote eco-friendly practices. Rick Fedrizzi, a key figure in green building, co-founded the U.S. Green Building Council, leading to the development of the LEED certification. Meanwhile, fossil fuel interests like ExxonMobil fueled climate change denial, deepening political polarization. The rise of political activism in the media further amplified division, hindering climate action and casting doubt on environmental science. And I'll get into all of that after the break. Episode 7, Counterintelligence. The 1970s marked a pivotal moment for environmentalism and architecture, with architects becoming skeptical of designing the energy-intensive glass and steel structures of the modern era. The energy crisis prompted a shift towards passive design, utilizing natural ventilation, daylight, and local materials to maintain comfortable temperatures without mechanical systems. This approach aimed to create buildings in harmony with their environment, reviving practices used throughout human history. In 1989, Kansas City architect Bob Birkenbeil urged the American Institute of Architects, or AIA, to promote eco-friendly practices. However, in the Reagan era, the environmental movement had a hippie image that the men in the AIA leadership were not prepared to associate with. Initially rejected by the board, Birkenbeil garnered support from up-and-coming architects from around the country, and at the May 1989 convention, successfully overruled the board to unanimously pass the CPR, Critical Planet Rescue Resolution. The resolution called for the AIA to act by creating resources that would help architects design more responsibly and educate clients and the industry about responsible environmental actions. This led to the creation of the AIA Committee on the Environment, or COAT, which collaborated with the EPA on environmental research and developed new architectural design guidelines. By August that same year, the EPA reported to Congress ground-shaking statistics that transformed the importance of the built environment.
Americans, on average, spend approximately 90% of their time indoors. Concentrations of some pollutants indoors are often 2 to 5 times higher than typical outdoor concentrations. And people who are often most susceptible to the adverse effects of pollution, i.e., the very young, older adults, people with cardiovascular or respiratory disease, tend to spend even more time indoors.
There was a realization that we need to optimize built environments for health and sustainability. Separately, a physical demonstration of this realization was on display in the foothills of Arizona's Santa Catalina Mountains. A 3-acre, airtight complex of geodesic domes, arched greenhouses, and pyramids containing a miniature rainforest, a mangrove, a desert, and a coral reef was constructed with the intent to house a team of people who would survive within the man-made ecosystem, with only the self-contained and sustained air to breathe, water to drink, and food to eat. Inspired by one of Buckminster Fuller's most popular works, Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth, a collective of individuals who split their time between experimental theater, farming, furniture making, building a geodesic dome, and even a functioning ship, saw themselves as picking up the pieces from the wreckage of civilization. The de facto leader of the group, John Allen, once said,
"Western civilization isn't simply dying, it's dead. We are probing into its ruins to take whatever is useful for the building of the new civilization to replace it.
Buckminster Fuller had coined the phrase Spaceship Earth to describe our planet. He felt that all human beings were passengers on Spaceship Earth, and like the crew of a large ship, people had to work together to keep the planet functioning properly. First published in 1969, Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth explores humanity's survival challenges, the impact of automation, and the need for resource efficiency. The group began dreaming of merging ecology and technology into a new form. One member, Ed Bass, was a Texas philanthropist who had inherited his family's oil fortune, but took on ecological causes. He used his wealth to seed many of the group's activities. With his financial support of $200 million, they created Space Biospheres Ventures. In 1984, they announced the project, Biosphere 2, which was meant to lay groundwork for future space colonization missions, as well as act as an environmental and social experiment. The goal was to build a closed system and see if humans could not only survive, but thrive and become self-sufficient. The first Biospherians, as they were called, were a team of 8 volunteers who would stay in Biosphere 2 for 2 years. The building was completed, and to much fanfare, the experiment launched in 1991. The night before the mission began, Space Biospheres Ventures hosted a dance party for 2,000 people, including Woody Harrelson and Timothy Leary. On the morning of September 26, 1991, the 8 Biospherians paraded around in front of the press wearing blue jumpsuits that gave an aura of costumes from Star Trek. In an interview with Discover magazine, Carl Hodges, a University of Arizona scientist, predicted it might turn out to be, quote, the most significant scientific project of all time. The ABC News program, Primetime Live, suggested that it might, quote, save the world. After the doors closed, however, there were significant challenges. Oxygen shortages, crop failures, and ecosystem imbalances. Despite initial media excitement and tourism, the project struggled with scientific credibility and transparency. Secret resupplies, equipment failures, and harsh critiques from experts led to its decline. Now here's a plot twist. With skyrocketing costs, Ed Bass reached out for help from none other than Steve Bannon. You may know Bannon now as a far-right political operative, chief advisor for Donald Trump's presidential campaign, or as the executive chairman of conservative media outlet Breitbart.com, which during his 4-year tenure, much of the website's content was devoted to debunking climate change with articles calling environmental activists, quote, pure scum, and putting the word science in quotes. But in 1993, Bannon ran an investment banking firm, Bannon and Company. While consulting on the project, Bannon shared
what a lot of the scientists who are studying global change and studying the effects of greenhouse gases, many of them feel that the Earth's atmosphere in 100 years is what the Biosphere 2's atmosphere is today. We have extraordinarily high CO2, we have very high nitrous oxide, we have high methane, and we have lower oxygen content. And so the power of this place is allowing those scientists who are really involved in study of global change, and which in the outside world of Biosphere 1 really have to work with just computer simulation, this actually allows them to study and monitor the impact of enhanced CO2 and other greenhouse gases on humans, plants, and in animals.
Bannon's involvement in Biosphere 2 was controversial, leading to 2 of the original Biospherians breaking into the dome to protest his management, contaminating another active experiment. Bannon was accused of harassing employees and threatening researchers. Despite his short, tumultuous leadership, the project continues under the University of Arizona, even conducting a 6-day mission with a crew of 4 as recently as 2023. Biosphere 2 aimed to pioneer sustainable living and space exploration. But through all the controversy of the first mission, it was initially seen as a failed experiment with minimal scientific value to show for it. Whether or not that is the case, it did ultimately expose the difficulties of replicating Earth's complex ecosystems and how important it is to maintain the one that we have. As the Biosphere 2 experiment was underway, building industry leaders beyond architects were also realizing that we need to optimize built environments for health and sustainability. In 1992, Rick Fedrizzi, a 25-year employee at Carrier Corp, a provider of HVAC, refrigeration, fire, and security equipment, was named Director of Environmental Marketing. His task was to rebrand the company's products as green. He accepted the position under the condition that the company actually make its products more sustainable instead of just saying they were. Over the next 3 years, the move was a success as Carrier increased its market share and revenues by $700 million, proving that being green and being profitable were not mutually exclusive. Throughout the 1990s, Fedrizzi continued to advance green building initiatives, becoming a prominent leader in the industry. In 1993, his activity garnered an invitation to join Birkenbeil's Coat Committee to retrofit the White House as a model for efficiency and waste reduction. Shortly thereafter, Birkenbeil hosted a meeting at the AIA offices in Washington, D.C., to brainstorm a new organization that could accommodate the interests of the emerging industry while leaving Coat to focus on the science of sustainable architecture, unfettered by the potential conflicts of interest. The 60-plus attendees included Fedrizzi, David Gottfried, a real estate developer, and Michael Italiano, an environmental lawyer. The trio volunteered to lead this new initiative, which became known as the U.S. Green Building Council. They discussed the betterment of building through sustainable practices and the creation of a green building rating system, which would later be known as Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED. The LEED Green Building Rating System is a third-party certification program to encourage sustainable practices, design, and development by means of tools and criteria for performance measurement and is one of the USGBC's most known contributions aside from its annual Green Build International Conference and Expo, the world's largest conference and expo dedicated to green building. The USGBC grew into a private 501c3 membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes sustainability in building design, construction, and operation. Its goal is to advance sustainability in the construction sector through lobbying, training, and certification initiatives. USGBC's policy platform reflects a holistic approach to green buildings, prioritizing outcomes that improve public health, create more equitable communities, strengthen resilience, support healthy ecosystems, and accelerate buildings as a foundational solution to the deepening climate crisis.
Well, I wish I could say it's changing quickly. It's taking a very long time, and I don't understand why. It's funny, the people that develop LEED buildings, gold, platinum buildings, they develop more of them, and somebody has to ask the question why. They didn't do one and then say, well, I don't want to do this ever again. I mean, maybe the process was a little onerous. Maybe, you know, you had to have teams get involved to a degree where they complained about a few things. But at the end of the day, the teams got better. They drove down efficiencies on every level. They made the end product a much more successful end product related to the financial, the economic performance of the building. And the owners of those buildings are saying, well, of course I want to do more of these. These buildings lease out in record time. They have higher tenant retention. They're more marketable. They have higher net value from the day they open to the day I sell it or if I choose to sell this asset. And so what we are trying to do is we are working with organizations, as we have for the past 10 years, But only now we're starting to see organizations like Fannie Mae offering a deep discount in financial rates for organizations that have committed to build a LEED platinum or gold building and ultimately have the ability to get it certified. It's about certification because mm-hmm. if you can't measure it, you in no way can say it's performing the way you wanted it to. The new story is about sustainability.
Pedruzzi's approach differed from others in the environmental movement, emphasizing incentives for responsible resource use and intelligent design for significant returns on investment. He was recently quoted saying,
"We are not going to save the planet by chaining ourselves to a fence. No disrespect to anyone who's had the guts to do that, but we have to find a way to incentivize the people who are most against environmental regulation. You can act responsibly, use less resources, and use them more intelligently, and your return on investment and your reward from your shareholders, your board, your employees, and your community is tenfold."
Internationally, in 1992, at the United Nations Conference on Environmental and Development, informally known as the Earth Summit, 154 countries signed an agreement known as the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC. This would be the UN's process for negotiating an agreement to limit, quote, dangerous human interference with the climate system, end quote. This development was followed by the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, which extended UNFCCC. To divvy responsibilities, the treaties established three categories of states: developed countries with special financial responsibilities, and developing countries. This structure acknowledged different financial capabilities in combating climate change and emphasized the obligation to reduce current emissions on developed countries on the basis that they are historically primary contributors to the current levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Now, this is where things get complex. The evolution of three sectors, politics, media, and corporate interests, synchronized, efficiently upending discourse on the subject. While incremental efforts to act on climate change continued at home and abroad, there were forces at play that would hinder widespread adoption. In the U.S., climate change views between the two political parties were not significantly different before the 1990s. But remember, this is the period where the U.S. political landscape became polarized, influenced by Newt Gingrich's transformation of the Republican Party and the shift in focus of think tanks from the executive to legislative branch. In addition, Climate Action's association to a maligned Clinton administration, who was elected to office in 1992 and 1996, made climate discourse unacceptable for some. Even today, many climate change deniers think of former Vice President Al Gore, who they loathe, when they hear the words climate change. The sentiment seemed to come out of nowhere, but in examining the evolution of everything from speech to organizational restructuring, political polarization paved the runway for denial about climate change. From a foundational level, gerrymandering, the practice of modifying boundaries of electoral districts to favor specific political interests, led to less competitive elections for House representatives, with one party holding sway over a particular district for years. Fewer swing districts mean that lawmakers are more likely to lose a primary election than a general election, so they are incentivized to take more extreme positions to beat out fellow party members on the assumption that this is what primary voters will prefer. The evolution of conservative media, supercharged by figures like Roger Ailes, Rush Limbaugh, and Steve Bannon, amplified harsh political speech and division on various topics, including climate. The conservative media activism that we know today actually dates back to 1953, as Henry Regnery, a publisher, gathered some of the brightest minds of the conservative movement in a meeting room in New York City. Regnery explained to the group,
The side we represent controls most of the wealth in this country. The ideas and traditions we believe in are those which most Americans instinctively believe in also.
Liberalism was ascending at the time, while he perceived conservatism to be relegated to the fringes. Regnery argued that the left-controlled institutions, media, universities, and the foreign policy establishment. He believed the right needed a, quote, counterintelligence unit that could fight back. The group that was present held conservative media ventures that included media outlets like Human Events, Regnery Publishing, The Mannion Forum, and National Review, among many others. Now, Regnery's worldview was shaped by his father, William Henry Regnery, a successful businessman in textile manufacturing. Initially a supporter of Franklin Roosevelt, he soon objected to the growth of the government's role in the domestic economy and Roosevelt's internationalism that indicated the U.S. could intervene in a European military conflict. In 1940, William, along with influential industry figures and well-connected individuals, founded the America First Committee, an American isolationist movement to pressure the United States against entry into World War II. The group rapidly grew to over 1 million members in just a year. Although initially presenting as patriotic, the group faced accusations of being pro-German, especially after Charles Lindbergh drew widespread criticism after a speech blaming, quote, the British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration for trying to draw America into World War II.
As the major agitators for war, I have included only those whose support is essential to the war party. If any of these groups, the British, the Jewish, or the administration, stops agitating for war, I believe there will be little danger of our involvement. I do not believe that any two of them are powerful enough to carry this country to war without the support of the third. And to these three, as I have said, all other groups are of secondary importance.
It also didn't help that over 20 sitting members of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives that were associated with the group were found to have colluded with an agent from Hitler's government to launder and spread Nazi propaganda in the U.S. Notably, this and other parallel plots led to the largest sedition trial in U.S. history, and these actions eventually weakened their support. In the wake of the America First Committee, Henry Regnery, who was also a member of the committee, used his family's fortune to establish a media empire that catered to a specific audience that shared in his ideologies. Those present at Regnery's meeting in 1953 forged close bonds over a shared belief that political change stemmed not just from ideas, but from spreading those ideas through openly ideological communication channels. Their media channels went on to diverge from previous conservative media outlets by mingling partisanship with news, establishing a new blueprint for media that tapped into the fear, anger, and grievances of its audience. They aimed to challenge the post-war liberal establishment by vigorously criticizing what they saw as liberal bias in mainstream media, questioning its claims of objectivity and accuracy. This effort to reveal biases was paired with promoting a conservative viewpoint that aligned with their ideology, reinforcing its beliefs, and gradually persuading more voters to support it, turning their audience into activists and a reliable voting base. By the late 1980s and early 90s, the same model had been adopted by a number of talk radio personalities, including Rush Limbaugh.
The evidence every day, folks, this is, I'm telling you, it is one of the most amazing sights to behold. There isn't any. There hasn't been any global warming, not man-made. There isn't any of any kind. The number one agent causing it has increased in volume exponentially, CO2, and there hasn't been any warming. And yet they're still pushing it. If there's no other way to convince, you've got to believe that this is all politics. It can only be politics keeping this alive. And it is a politics that intentionally insults the intelligence of people and preys on the stupid and the dumb and the weak. Intentionally, in order to gain popular support. And by that I mean, they focus on people who have, in their own estimation, meaningless lives. They're wondering what their purpose is. Why am I here? Why am I driving this clunker car? Why can't I go to good job? Why am I here? And then all of a sudden, those people hear they can save the planet. Now that big. You go from mattering not at all to being a key ingredient to saving the planet. You sign up right then and you do whatever, and then you let everybody know you're doing it. So you go buy a Prius and you go support all this madcap crazy stuff and you become an evangel and you are saving the planet and your new life has meaning. And that's what I mean by preying on the weak, the dumb, the stupid. How many times have you heard anybody on TV who's being interviewed for some achievement, some accomplishment, for some reason, and the person, usually a Hollywood actress, but it could be anybody. I want to make a difference. How many times have you heard that? Well, that's what they pray on. I want to make it. You want to make a difference? Fine. You can save the planet. Now, you've helped destroy it. We know you didn't mean to. But you unwittingly, by driving the car you drove or eating McDonald's, you know, eating whatever you were destroying the planet. But now you can atone. You must vote Democrat, support big government, the welfare state, and cut back on progress. And if you do all that, we'll love you. We'll take care of you. Just vote for us and you can save the planet. And that's how they prey on them. And they can make a difference. Hitler made a difference.
Limbaugh was a master of provocative language. The Rush Limbaugh Show, which first aired in 1984 and was nationally syndicated on AM and FM radio stations from 1988 until his death in 2021, aired on close to 300 radio stations and boasted more than 5 million listeners weekly by 1990. But the genius lied in Roger Ailes, who took the model to cable television. Ailes, a successful executive producer in the 1960s, entered the political arena after meeting Republican presidential candidate Richard Nixon on the set of The Mike Douglas Show and being asked to provide his television expertise as the campaign's media advisor. He was also involved in President Reagan's re-election campaign and President Bush's 1988 election. Ailes first pitched the idea of a conservative news network to Nixon and approached Joseph Coors in the 1970s to finance it. But it wouldn't come to fruition until 1996, when Ailes was commissioned by Rupert Murdoch to create Fox News Channel, a new arm of Murdoch's media empire. Ailes, a conservative populist and nationalist, was thought to transcend traditional conservatism by using Fox News as his personal megaphone. He built a network news juggernaut that, notwithstanding its slogan of fair and balanced, was frequently under fire for mingling partisanship with news. The effects? When it came to American support for climate action, it went into decline. A 1997 Pew survey showed that the percentage of people who worried a, quote, great deal about various aspects of climate issues were trending downward between 1990 and 1997. Concerns about pollution of rivers, lakes, and reservoirs declined from 64% to 61%. Toxic waste contamination of soil and water from 63% to 59%. Air pollution, 58% to 47%. The loss of natural habitat for wildlife, 51% to 46%. The loss of tropical rainforests actually went up from 40% to 44%. But concerns about the greenhouse effect, or global warming, ranked well below other environmental dangers on the public's alarm list, decreasing from 30% in 1990 to 24% in 1997. At the corporate level, Exxon and other oil companies made a conscious decision to sow doubt instead of improving their products and the industry. Again, after thorough internal research, analysis, and confirmation that human activities impact the climate, ExxonMobil became a leader in campaigns of confusion. In 1989, Exxon helped establish a group called the Global Climate Coalition, which was charged with the task of casting doubt on climate change. Their capital fueled the rising division that was needed to confuse and distract to maintain the status quo. The number one focus at the time was the Kyoto Protocol. ExxonMobil lobbied against it, arguing it was too costly and burdened developed nations unfairly. This language can be heard through Senators Byrd and Hagel's introduction of a resolution to the Senate floor.
Why is this administration rushing headlong into signing a treaty in Kyoto this December? The scientific data is inconclusive, even contradictory. The economic costs are clear and devastating. This treaty would be a lead weight on our nation's future economic growth, killing jobs and opportunities for generations of Americans to come. We need to take global climate issues seriously. Obviously, we agree with that. We in the United States have made tremendous strides in cleaning up our environment. We'll continue to make progress in the future. We are all concerned about the state of the environment and what we leave to our children and our grandchildren. But when we take actions that will reduce our children and our grandchildren's economic opportunities, we must ensure that the benefits are real and that they would justify this very real economic hardship that we would be passing on to these future generations.
I do not think the Senate should support a treaty that requires only half of the world, in other words, the developed countries, to endure the economic costs of reducing emissions, while developing countries are free to pollute the atmosphere, and in so doing, siphon off American industries. There are those who say that the United States is responsible for the situation that is developing. And they claim that the United States should bear the brunt of the burden. But the time for pointing fingers is over. In this particular environmental game, there are no winners. The world loses. And any effort to avoid the effects of global climate change will be doomed to failure from the start without the participation of the developing world, particularly those nations that are rapidly developing and will rapidly increase their carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. Count me as a global environmentalist who insists that all nations that spew forth major concentrations of carbon dioxide, or that will be spewing forth major concentrations of carbon dioxide, must step up to the plate in these negotiations and make good faith, specific, binding commitments to control and reduce these emissions. Industry is fueled in large part.
In July 1997, 5 months before the Kyoto meeting, the U.S. Senate passed the Byrd-Hagel resolution stating that
the United States should not be a signatory to any protocol which would A, mandate new commitments to limit or reduce greenhouse gas emissions for the Annex I parties, unless the protocol also mandates new specific scheduled commitments for developing country parties within the same compliance period, or B, result in serious harm to the economy of the United States.
Byrd-Hagel passed by a 95-0 vote, achieving ratification and requiring two-thirds of the Senate to change the resolution, a monumental task. Most American citizens were initially willing to join other countries in setting standards to improve the global environment, and a majority would even pay more for gasoline to reduce global warming. But by December 1997, on the eve of the Kyoto Conference, the American public strongly rejected the notion that the United States should bear more of the burden of repairing the environment than poorer countries, even when considering that these nations have not caused as much damage as the U.S. The Republican Party, considered more pro-business, was a natural bridge to defend oil and natural gas interests. opinions on the issue began to split upon party lines. A 50% majority of Republicans opposed the Kyoto Protocol, while a 56% majority of Democrats were in favor. Ultimately, the Kyoto Protocol was adopted on December 11, 1997, and was initially signed by 37 nations. Those that did commit were legally bound to reduce their emissions by a certain amount between 2008 through 2012. But, to the oil company's delight, the United States was not one of them. These collective efforts not only worked in the US, but also stopped other countries such as China and India from signing the Kyoto Protocol. But it didn't stop there. To minimize future adoptees, the American Petroleum Institute and other fossil fuel interests continue to invest in efforts to sow doubt about climate science. In fact, in 1998, a team under the American Petroleum Institute, called Global Climate Science Team, outlined a roadmap for climate deception. According to the memo, quote,
"Victory will be achieved when average citizens understand or recognize uncertainties in climate science. Recognition of uncertainties becomes part of the conventional wisdom. Media understands or recognizes uncertainties in climate science. Media coverage reflects balance on climate science and recognition of the validity of viewpoints that challenge the current conventional wisdom. Industry senior leadership understands uncertainties in climate science, making them stronger ambassadors to those who shape climate policy. Those promoting the Kyoto Treaty on the basis of extant science appear to be out of touch with reality."
While much of the capital for these efforts through the 1990s are unknown, a 2013 study by Drexel University environmental sociologist Robert Brule provides a sense of the funding network. The study is the first academic effort to probe the organizational underpinnings and finances behind the climate denial movement. The study revealed that from 2003 to 2007, foundations associated with the Koch family and ExxonMobil heavily funded climate change denial efforts. Again, the Koch foundations are created by Charles and David Koch, two sons of Fred C. Koch, who own the majority of Koch Industries, an oil, gas, paper, and chemical conglomerate, which is the U.S.'s second largest privately held company. After 2007, however, publicly traceable funding from Exxon and the Koch Foundation decreased as dark money sources increased. The way that these funding networks operate is that there are essentially three tiers. At the hidden top, corporate interest money that is distributed through corporate or family foundations. The second tier are third-party donor-directed foundations like Donors Trust and Donors Capital, whose initial funding sources cannot be traced, disguising any biases. Then, the last tier are the organizations that put the funds to use and execute on the task at hand. The study found that half of the funds to climate denial organizations came from Donors Trust and Donors Capital alone. According to the study, from 2003 to 2010, the largest, most consistent funding sources for the climate denial movement have come from several well-funded conservative foundations. Based on Brule's research, 140 traceable foundations funneled $558 million to 91 climate denial organizations to lobby or sway public opinion on climate change and other issues. An example of these efforts to sway public opinion was a nonprofit organization known as the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine, or OISM, led by climate change skeptic Arthur Robinson. OISM aimed to bolster the climate denial movement with its controversial Oregon Petition. Launched in 1998, the petition claimed that over 31,000 scientists, including 9,000 with PhDs, rejected the consensus on human-caused climate change. Frederick Sace, a physicist and former tobacco industry lobbyist, supported the petition, lending his name as a former president of the National Academy of Sciences, despite the Academy publicly distancing itself from his views. At the time, Sace was also chairman of the George C. Marshall Institute, a nonprofit conservative think tank that received extensive financial support from the fossil fuel industry. Critics have questioned the petition's legitimacy, noting that only 39 signatories were actual climatologists. The petition's credibility was further undermined by instances of prank submissions, including names like Charles Darwin and fictional characters from Star Wars. Moreover, Robinson's scientific reputation is disputed, with claims that he has not published peer-reviewed research in decades and has made dubious assertions such as promoting the health benefits of ionizing radiation. Despite these issues, the Oregon petition continues to be cited by climate change skeptics as evidence of scientific dissent, illustrating a strategic effort to challenge the overwhelming consensus on climate change and influence public opinion in favor of fossil fuel interests. However, it wasn't until 2015 that the public would begin to find out about much of Exxon's engagement in these efforts. The result of an 8-month-long investigation conducted by Inside Climate News was the book Exxon, The Road Not Taken. The 4-decade story draws from uncovered internal files, interviews with former employees, and other evidence revealing how Exxon led groundbreaking climate research only to later spearhead climate denial. But in 2021, the public finally heard it directly from the source.
Did we aggressively fight against some of the science? Yes. Did we join some of these shadow groups to work against some of the early efforts? Yes, that's true. But there's nothing illegal about that. You know, we were looking out for our investments. We were looking out for our shareholders.
This is Keith McCoy, Senior Director of Federal Relations at ExxonMobil, who believes he is being headhunted for a new job. In fact, Greenpeace UK is conducting an undercover investigation which revealed him speaking candidly about Exxon's efforts to undermine climate action.
When you have an opportunity to talk to a member of Congress, you know, I liken it to fishing, right? You have bait, you throw that bait out, you know, it's all these opportunities that you use, and to use the fishing analogy again, just to kind of reel them in, because they're a captive audience. They know they need you and I need them. You want to be able to go to the chief. Yeah. And so the chief knows you, that you can go to the chief and say, look, we've got this issue. We need Congressman so-and-so to be able to introduce this bill. We need him to make a floor statement. We need him to send a letter. Yeah. You name it. We've asked for everything.
The next step for fossil fuel and allied interests was to link climate action to liberal agendas, deepening polarization. Conservative politicians slowly transitioned from understanding climate action is needed, but having concerns about the financial impacts of solutions, to completely denying that climate change is real. As late as 2008, even Newt Gingrich agreed to film a PSA for climate protection.
Hi, I'm Nancy Pelosi, lifelong Democrat and Speaker of the House.
And I'm Newt Gingrich, lifelong Republican, and I used to be Speaker.
We don't always see eye to eye, do we, Newt?
No, but we do agree our country must take action to address climate change.
We need cleaner forms of energy, and we need them fast.
If enough of us demand action from our leaders, we can spark the innovation we need.
Go to wecansolveit.org. Together, we can do this.
But just that same year, in front of several business executives from the largest corporations in the world, he displayed more uncertainty.
Let's just sort of begin at the beginning with at least the question that historically has been the most controversial question here, and that is, to what degree are human beings contributing to global warming? Why don't we start with you, Mr. Gingrich? Newt, sorry.
Well, I'm not sure that's where I thought you'd start, but let me just say, because I'm not sure that that's the most important question about the environment, but as a historian, I doubt if we know. It is probable that carbon is a risk. And I argue in Contract with the Earth that because I'm a conservative in the traditional sense, which means avoiding stupid risks, I think we should lower the carbon impact on the planet, because the truth is we don't know for sure. But I, in fact, don't know to what extent the human race contributes to climate change. And let me just make this observation for all of you. The sun is overwhelmingly the dominant contributor to climate. Every 75,000 years in the Triassic, which is the first part of the age of the dinosaurs, we had fundamental changes in how the Earth operated, because it would shift where its magnetic pole was, and it would shift the amount of radiation it was getting. We've had a very long period of sunspots having an enormous impact on climate. 11,000 years ago, the entire process of the Gulf Stream stopped. In one morning, there was no Gulf Stream. When there was no Gulf Stream, there was no gigantic oceanic conveyor of heat to Europe. When you don't get the Gulf Stream in Europe, you get an ice age. For 600 years, you had an ice age. And for reasons we don't know, the Gulf Stream started. Now, it had been there before, and it came after. The ice age receded. The truth is, nobody knows this stuff. And I'm always dubious when scientists behave as politicians. When you see 11,000 scientists sign something, you know it's not science, it's politics. Because science is one person telling the truth and defending it with facts. But science is not 11,000 people signing a petition. So my first reaction is, I think we should behave as though global warming is a threat, and I think we should limit the carbon loading of the atmosphere as an act of prudence. But I couldn't possibly tell you what share of the climate we're creating. And I think it's an act of hubris on the part of humans to fantasize that they are more important than the sun.
By 2012, as a Republican presidential candidate, there was much more opposition on display.
I mean, first of all, it hasn't been totally proven. Second, even if it were proven, there are a lot of different solutions other than cap and trade and turning over the entire economy to the EPA. I opposed cap and trade. I testified, you can see it at newt.org, we have the video. I testified at the U.S. House, but you can just say to your son, I am opposed to cap and trade. He is safe. And I also am an amateur paleontologist, so I've spent a lot of time looking at the Earth's temperature over a very long time. And I'm a lot harder to convince than just looking at a computer model.
An August 2024 report showed that climate change deniers now make up nearly a quarter of the U.S. Congress, 23 senators and 100 House representatives. With today's technology, including social media, efforts to sow doubt about climate science have expanded beyond politicians. Newt Gingrich fell short in identifying that the news media loved fights. Society as a whole does. But it's not for the simple reason of just loving a fight. According to psychologists, our emotions evolve to help us maintain social status in small communities, making expressing outrage a way to elevate one's standing. This is why expressing outrage often feels rewarding. Now, in today's outrage economy, being divisive and controversial can attract followers, drive engagement, and generate income. Outrage is financially incentivized. However, this fuels division and distracts from real issues that affect everyone. Moreover, division appears to be built into the system of social media, and its uncontrolled spread of anonymous accounts and bots amplify the effect even more. To understand biases emerging from Twitter, a 2021 study by Nature Communications divided 15 Twitter bots into groups based on their initial alignment with news sources across the political spectrum. Over 5 months, the bots with more partisan initial sources, especially right-leaning, gained followers faster and formed stronger echo chambers than centrist bots. Right-leaning bots were also more exposed to low-credibility content and more likely to follow automated accounts. Meanwhile, left-leaning bots tended to drift towards the political center, consuming and sharing more conservative content over time, highlighting the impact of initial media exposure on online behavior and political polarization and radicalization. The effects? When it comes to climate, a 2021 Pew Research study showed that Democrats were more likely to rate climate scientists positively in their understanding of whether climate change is occurring and why, while Republicans have become less likely to give these scientists positive remarks on these questions. For example, 57% of Democrats said climate scientists understand, quote, very well whether climate change is occurring, compared with just 14% of Republicans. That 43-point gap was up from a 25-point difference in 2016. But there's a silver lining. Another Pew Research Center study from 2017 analyzed 1.2 million tweets to determine how bots influence Twitter content. The study found that suspected bots were responsible for 66% of all tweeted links, including 66% of links to news and current event sites. Notably, 89% of links to news aggregation sites were posted by bots, and just 500 of the most active bots were responsible for 22% of all links to popular news sites, far outpacing the 500 most active human users with an estimated 6%. If we can rally around that and understand the level of automated manipulation that is occurring, there may be room to come together. Political polarization has left a lasting impact on the environmental movement, hindering action on climate change due to manufactured confusion and doubt. Fossil fuel interests were wildly successful in their efforts. By the late 1990s, recognition of uncertainties about climate change was now part of the conventional wisdom. These efforts will continue to reverberate throughout policy debates, even directly attacking the green building movement. Next time on Going Green.
And fear and anger have to be part of this campaign. If you want to win, that's what we're going to do. We're not going to get people to like the oil and gas industry over the next few months. And there is no sympathy for the oil and gas industry, so we're not going to tap into, I'm sympathetic to all those poor guys who are running the energy companies. What you've got to do is you got to get people fearful about what is on the table, and you got to get people angry over the fact that they're being misled. Nobody likes being lied to. Nobody likes being told that, oh, this won't hurt. And so that is central to the messaging campaign going forward.
Thanks for listening. Going Green is a Spaces podcast story brought to you by Lines. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question, want to submit a correction, or just share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. That's lynes.studio/podcasts. And listen in to my wrap-up episode to hear my response. If you're looking for similar content, Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content that I found during my research, you can visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.